Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Based on his photos and his appearances on ESPN with Scott Van Pelt, it appears that Spencer Hall is a bear who has cleaned up just enough to pass for a man. Somewhere under all that fur, or hair, is America's sharpest mind on the subject of college football. It's a sport we care the most about in the South, the source of glory and hate and dominance. Teams from the South have won 17 of the last 20 national championships. But Spencer and I aren't going to talk about who's going to win the Heisman this year. Things get a little bit weirder than that.
I'm not so sure about pigs, man. There might be like a quiet anxiety behind the otherwise happy, content eyes of the pig. I've seen Babe. It gets dark in there.
Spencer writes about college football for the website SB Nation. We cover a lot of ground here, including one key question. Should we be watching college football in the first place? Here's our conversation. So, Spencer Hall, I want to start with a question that's sort of near to our hearts here in North Carolina. 13 North Carolina Tar Heels football players have been suspended for selling their school-provided sneakers for up to, I believe, $2,500 apiece. My first question to you about this is, does the fact that a pair of sneakers was once owned by a North Carolina football player raise their value or lower it?
They're pre-owned, technically, so I think that lowers it. I'd like to remove any slander or libel that might happen, either spoken or on a transcript of this, by atomizing the conversation and saying that pre-owned is always a little less valuable than fresh out the box. Although if I was going historically, I would say that North Carolina football is neutral, so no change.
So neutral value on sort of, you know, your basic pre-owned items, North Carolina is not going to give you anything and not going to cost you anything.
Correct. Unless these are worn by, let's see, Julius Peppers maybe, or Lawrence Taylor, then no, there will be no effect. This is pending any sort of outcomes of Mitch Trubisky's professional career. And even then, I don't think that it's going to add that much, because let's face it, I don't know a time when a Chicago Bears quarterback has really turned the corner and added much value to anything since Jim McMahon.
My second question about this is this a hanging offense, or is this merely something that they should, you know, spend the rest of their lives in jail for?
Under the jail. There's absolutely no way that we should compensate people for their labor. So I think that under the jail, if we could build the jail under the jail, there was a movie once called Prison in Hell, which was for people in hell who were so bad that they had to go to prison in hell. That's what we need to do. If you think I'm being serious on this, you shouldn't be listening to this. I'll just
That probably should be a disclaimer for the whole thing. But we'll...
the bar is this high. You either trip over it or leap into this race, man.
I want to ask another question about another subject that I think is also crucially important to this upcoming college football season. Jim Harbaugh, the Michigan coach, advised a former player not to eat chicken because, as he says, it's a nervous bird. So What would you advise your college football playing? So if you were a coach, what would you advise your players to consume instead?
I would probably go, if you were concerned about a nervous bird, then I would want a high protein, like a good source of protein that was had enough fat but not too much. And obviously, if we're doing temperament-based eating, I think you have to go with something large and placid. That, to me, says, you know, your beefs, your bison, your buffalo, your larger animals. I'm not so sure about pigs, man. There might be like a quiet anxiety behind the otherwise happy, content eyes of the pig. I've seen Babe. It gets dark in there.
There does seem to be a lot of snuffling, too, which I'm not sure what that means.
They're smart and they're greed. Like, if you got pigs are greedy. If you got greed in your soul, then chances are you probably got a couple other demons lurking. So I think pork is a second option. You want something that's, you know, a big, beatific, wonderful animal to slaughter. That took the turn that I didn't want it to. But yeah, I would say that, you know, if you want calm, go with that. Alternately, if you're not feeling that, there's always tofu, because I can't think of a more emotionally inert experience than a block of solid tofu.
I know little bits about you from some of the stuff you've written, but I don't really know sort of all the pieces together. So can you just tell us a little bit about kind of where you grew up, what your folks did? You know, I know it seemed like I remember from some of the stuff you've written that you guys moved around quite a bit, right?
We did. We moved around a bit. Not quite army brat pace, but my folks got married right out of high school. They're from suburban Nashville. And originally my dad's people were from Diana, Tennessee. And
now, I know Tennessee a little bit, but I don't know Diana.
Yeah, dude, I don't really even know if Diana's there anymore. I know that my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, is from Cuba Landing, which you say, isn't that a place where you dock your boat? Yep, used to be a town there. And then they covered it up with a lake, was the story. So the TVA decided that my grandmother's home looked better at the bottom of a lake than beside it. And can't really complain. Got electricity out of the deal. So
I was going to say, I believe that's not just one, but maybe two drive-by trucker songs out of that.
At least. There's a couple more back there. My grandfather, he pops up sometime. My paternal grandfather pops up sometime, I reckon, because he was a horse trainer. And he was connected to college football long before I was, because he was a seasonal drinking buddy of Bear Bryant's. And I think that was a good thing, because if you were a year-round drinking buddy of Bear Bryant, I don't think you lived that long. And he was a horse trainer and eventually lived in Louisville. But my dad moved around a lot, and he never really stopped moving, which was fine because he worked in the restaurant industry. My parents got married right out of high school. My dad worked in fast food. Like, there's pictures of me with my dad in a Wendy's uniform, and I've got like the little Wendy's cap on because I was a surprise. I was not really supposed to happen.
And today, do you go to Wendy's, or is there like now a lifelong sort of like, I had too much of that?
I will always have a little bit of affection. Always, just the smell alone. You know, they've remodeled it since. I think, but I always wanted one of those. Remember, they used to have a newsprint table?
Sure.
Right? It was like vintage newsprint. Like, Wendy's wanted to look like, you know, they'd papered their tables with newspapers from, like, Ohio in the 1890s, right? And I always wanted one of those tables. So if you got one of those, hit me up, because I would love to have it in my house. And my dad, we ended up moving a lot. Kind of that class of people who are definitely above lower middle class sometimes, and maybe close to upper middle class sometimes, but always sort of riding the dragon of the economy, which there are few industries that are as tied to the schizophrenia of the American economy as fast food or large retail eating. Later, my dad worked for a couple of other chain restaurants, including a sit-down joint, and you know, every time the economy hiccuped, you know, they caught the plague. That was how it worked. So we ended up moving around a lot, but mostly around the South. So, I went to high school in both Florida and in Tennessee. I went to elementary and middle school in both Tennessee and in Georgia. Also a stint in South Carolina. Really, all of the finest bugs and insects. That's pretty much my childhood. Bugs, wait, insects, and heat.
I was going to say, was most of your childhood spent above or below the net line?
Most of it was spent above, right? For those of you not familiar with the Nat Line is it's a geological divide.
I didn't realize
this. It's a change in the aquifer that really encourages the massive populations of gnats that live in, say, Statesboro, Georgia in the South, but don't live up here in Atlanta. So I was really only below the Nat Line once we moved to Florida for high school, and that's where I ended up graduating. I kind of lucked into a scholarship at the University of Florida, and that's how I got here.
And was college football part of your life, something you look forward to on Saturdays way back when? It would seem like if you moved around a lot, maybe it was harder to latch onto a team. I don't know.
No. And neither my mom nor dad went to a college. Now, that doesn't—that's no obstacle to college football fandom, and never
exactly
has been
not,
in the South.
Yeah.
Right? Fandom is local, and it is not earned, purchased, or even leased. You just decide that that's your team, sometimes even without a real sort of geographical or familial tie-in. That helps, but sometimes people just decide, hey, man, I'm a Clemson fan. Okay, cool. You're there. It's done. It's like being saved. You just say, hey, I accept the Lord, and there you are. Dabo Swinney is, you know, at your front door, ready for you to join the tribe. I was never, like growing up, I was never athletic, not particularly coordinated or gifted athletically or physically, but and I never really followed college football, but even then you get a pretty good residual knowledge just from living here and living where I lived. You know, I was pretty much a geek. I didn't want anything to do with sports. But in sixth grade, I knew who Reggie Cobb was. And in fourth grade, you know, I knew exactly what was going on in Alabama because my dad was an Alabama fan because my grandfather hung out with Bear Bryant.
Right.
And we did everything but root for Tennessee because I had Vanderbilt people on one side. Didn't go there, mind you. Just Nashville people who weren't going to be caught dead wearing orange or tangerine-ish, you know, white. That's
kind of the dream. No. That's sort of the dreamsicle orange is what I think
of. Well, it's, you know what it is? I actually, Holly Anderson is like longtime co-writer and partner on the site and worked for Grantland and MTV News and is a magnificent writer. She told me that is the color of a flower on the campus, and it is the only place on campus that has it, and it is that exact shade. Which I did not know. Like, you should know these things about schools, right? It's these flowers that grow by one of the oldest buildings on Tennessee's campus, and that's why they ended up using that color. It's not hunting orange because, frankly, a couple of shades off.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, I know it makes a good joke, but it's the color of the flowers, and that's what they decided to use for the University of Tennessee's, like, you know, uniforms. It's not some kind of connection to the name. It's not anything other than the most sort of sweetest particular local tie-in.
It is funny what you know, or I guess absorb, because of sports or whatever. I could tell you the entire story of Condridge Holloway's career at Tennessee, but I had no freaking idea where the flower had it, that a flower had anything to do with the color. So it's somehow that seems like something that Keith Jackson should have told us at some point, but he didn't, I guess.
Okay, there's a lot of things Keith should have told us, man. To be fair, I don't think Keith had the time, inclination, or access to do all of those things. But yeah, like there's my one thing that's been in doing, you know, what I accidentally ended up doing. You end up finding out a lot about the places and the people and how connected they are and intertwined, for better or worse, with the places they represent. I don't think that the Chicago Bears, or I don't think that the LA Rams, and I don't think that even the New Orleans Saints will ever be as tied into a community the way that a place that sprang up there and uses its, you know, just the way they look and the words that they are used to describe said team, you know, they all come from not just a particular place, but a place that can't move and a place that won't evolve too much away from what it was originally intended to be.
Right, like Auburn's not going to go build an expansion team somewhere else and just start over, and it's always going to be there.
Yeah, and that's not only a bug, it's a feature, right? It doesn't really get changed. We really only change things when we decide that, well, maybe the thing that this is referencing is something that we find societally unacceptable, which has happened. And for good, or it's a cheer that pops up and a tradition that later we revisit and go, I don't know. Could you play that on TV? Should the kids hear that? I'm mostly talking to you, LSU. But that happens too.
Yeah. And so at what point, or maybe it was not till you got to Florida, at what point did you sort of develop a team that you thought, this is my team?
It was when I attended Florida.
Yeah.
It was not, and not a second before. I was occupied with other things, like not doing my homework and not really working that hard and not assuming I had any kind of potential. And that was pretty much until my junior year of high school. Tennessee public schools were so bad. And growing up in Tennessee is such a bad place to be smart. And I mean the kind of smart that has opinions on things. I don't mean the kind of smart that does math. Because everybody goes, well, that'll make money. But if you have opinions on things or you enjoy reading and you are in the least bit, let's say, artsy in the wrong way, it's a real bad place to be. So when I got to Florida, it was the first time since maybe second grade that anyone had said, maybe you can go to college. I mean, before that, no offense to Middle Tennessee State University, I was bound to be a dropout from MTSU. And did not pay attention to sports, didn't really want to be a part of that because of everything it signified. And all of the people, you know, that looked at you and said, yeah, this is nothing, that you can't live here. You can't be here, right? This is not, you know, that's cool and everything. That's great. You should go somewhere else. So when I went somewhere else, they, you know, it wasn't even like, but this isn't like an escape to the coasts story, right?
It's Gainesville.
I moved to Tampa and then went to Gainesville, right? It's not, it's a very, very small step upward, right? But it was a crucial one because it got me to Florida and I was in the band. I got to go to every game.
What'd you play?
I played trumpet and French horn badly. Huh. Both of them. I was mediocre at both.
And was at Florida the first sort of big time SEC game you'd ever been to?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think the first big conference game that I remember definitively was losing to Auburn. Like I have memories of other games. I remember 1994 losing to Patrick Nix and Auburn and Terry Dean throwing five picks. I remember that like it was like that's when it got photographic.
Yeah. And I've always wondered, so is it impossible to really experience a game well as somebody in the band? I mean, it feels like such a different experience because you guys are working, right?
Working is a strong word for what the band does. It really is. You do have to be concerned. The chief obstacle to enjoying a game in the band, really, is your seats. You're in the end zone.
Right.
So consequently, you don't really see a lot of, you know, formations, who's doing what, where they're doing stuff, you know. That next year, 1995, for instance, I believe Tennessee was up something like 31-10 on us or 31-14 at the half. And then in the third and the fourth quarter, Florida stormed back and eventually scored, I believe 60 points on them, 50 points, and blew them out.
Sure,
right?
I remember the game, yeah.
Yeah, it was one of four times that, you know, Peyton Manning's year was ruined by Florida. And, you know, I remember watching that game on replay, and I never saw what happened. I just saw the ball going up a lot, right? And going up towards the same people over and over again and thinking, I wonder what they're doing. And you'd watch it later and go, oh, they're running this play. They're running Mills, and they're, you know, throwing to this, and they're asking the safety to cover. You know, like, you can't see any of that in the band. So your analytics, your X's and O's, they're going to be a little weak. Also, yeah, you got to be on the field for halftime, and you got to be off at the end of halftime, or the punter and the kicker are going to start doing, they're going to start practicing in the middle of your formations.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing is, like, you see the ball go up in the air, you hear a cheer, and all you know is, okay, I got to play something now, right?
Oh, yeah, you know what to play. Like, that's not even thinking, right? You're like, oh, I got to play orange and blue. You always play the same things. Most college bands are hitting the same three, maybe four songs over and over and over again, right? There's very few sort of features even for big college football marching bands, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think you said something about this the other day. It's sort of time for an upgrade, not just for the band music, I guess, but for the, like, the stadium music. There's a little too much like Enter Sandman out there.
You know, Virginia Tech gets to keep Enter Sandman.
I think so. That's true.
That's fine. They get to keep it. It's very hard because you have to balance a bunch of demographics inside that stadium that don't necessarily subscribe to the same culture of the month club. There's a lot of that going on. You have young, mostly African-American players who undoubtedly will want mumble rap. They'll want some kind of deep post-trap music playing over the speakers, which they get during practice. You have boosters who, if I said the words mumble rap, you just get a blank expression crosses their face.
They'd be isn't all rap mumble rap? That's a
yeah. Yeah, you go, sure. Just keep writing checks, sir. Just keep, yeah. They would like some country. Maybe they would like some extremely old arena-style rock and roll of some sort, right? And that's why everybody ends up playing AC/DC. You just end up playing, like, Thunderstruck. Because everyone can kind of agree on Thunderstruck, and we need to move past that as a nation. Y'all, all people, you need to learn some new stuff.
I do feel like the two songs in the American music canon through sports that somehow everybody seems to agree on are Thunderstruck and YMCA. And I just, you know, that seems to be just, there needs to be like an American studies course just on those two things.
I think it is. I don't think it's a shame because I think the song is incredible. But there's a very old song at this point that has the greatest potential for intro, and I've always wanted somebody to use it. If you just use the intro to Killing in the Name Of by Rage Against the Machine, it's tuned for a stadium, right? It is tuned to be played in an 80,000, 100,000 seat joint, right? There are very few music directors who really understand, or people who are doing the music for a stadium, who understand that they are sitting on the biggest subwoofer on the planet, right? You just play it off that concrete, it's going to bang. LSU does this. They play Onto the Next One by Jay-Z, and it has this gigantic bass note that just hits like on like the two and the four, right? And you know that that director thought about it because the way it sounds in that stadium, the vibrations aren't just coming from the speakers, right? The structure is picking up a little bit of it. And I thought, you know, you really put some thought into this, right? Of all the things that Louisiana might not invest in and might not devote thought to as a unit, someone in that state really considered how good bass would sound off of sections 102 and 103.
Somebody's majoring in bass there, and rightfully so, I think. So now, when you got out of Florida, I assume college football writer was not your first job?
No. I didn't even know what. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Right.
I didn't know what I was going to do. I went immediately after graduating. I went with my wife. We got married like straight out of university. It's a terrible idea. Don't get married young. Don't get married out of college. We were the people who had a plane crash. And everyone else died, and we're sitting in the seats on the runway going, well, that worked. Like, it worked for us. I don't think it works for everybody, right? But we ended up getting married and moving to Taiwan, to the Republic of China, for a year to teach English.
And then what after that?
It's been about 6 months just backpacking, not contributing to any form of society or doing anything productive at all. And then after that, ended up bouncing around Florida and then a little bit North Carolina. We hung out at a house there because it was rent-free in the country. Turns out, like, we were in a town where the only jobs were in a factory. And I thought, that's probably not going to cut it long-term. We should move somewhere. So we moved to Atlanta. My wife got a job here. And I ended up waiting tables for a while before I ended up working with refugees because I'd been teaching English and needed somebody who could teach English and also kind of run a vocational program. I'd done one, but not both, but that was enough. And ended up working for refugee resettlement here for a while.
Yeah. And I think most people who know you from college football, or at least the people who've been following you for a long time, you know you as the guy behind, I guess, kind of a self-started Every Day Should Be Saturday, which is still your Twitter handle. Now, was that just you at home at night writing about college football? I mean, how did that start?
Yeah, I was underemployed. I was underemployed and bored. And I was very into football. I've been watching compulsively since, 1994. And which is a great time, by the way, to sort of come alive as a college football fan, because every single year you got to watch more of it, right? There was simply more and more and more of it on, and more venues and more channels to watch it on. So at one point I thought, well, we'll hit a saturation point. I will only be able to watch so much. And that really hasn't happened yet after, 24 years of doing this very intensely. So I hope it'll happen. We'll see. Maybe if the Conference USA has its own channel, Sun Belt steps up, maybe. But I didn't really fit in anywhere online in terms of discussion or forum. So I started my own site and just started writing. And I thought, and I found that I could actually write pretty compulsively and consistently about it. So that's how it got started. It got started on, you know, like a blog spot, basically, and then kind of took off from there. And I, you know, I don't really have a lot of writing advice for somebody at all. You know, I still don't think I know how to do it. It's basically new every single time I start. But the one thing that I would say for anybody who has a lot of anxiety about just beginning typing, what I would consider typing, not writing, right, is to write about a subject. And that subject, you know, if you can write about a subject and give it some gravity and detail and attention that maybe it doesn't have and it hasn't gotten, right? Find something that you think has been neglected. Find something you think hasn't gotten enough due and that you're sort of, you know, not write what you know, right? Like, you could write about something you're passionate about that you're just learning about. And I think that role fits a lot of people who I know ended up becoming sort of online writers, is that they just had a topic that, even though they weren't really knowledgeable about it, they ended up being pretty knowledgeable just because they liked it, right? A lot of automotive writers I know are like that. A lot of, you know, I think Bill Simmons is an example of that, because you could see at one point he eventually became not only knowledgeable but sourced, because he was talking to people. And that changes that, you know, and that changes how you write, right? That changes who you are, and that changes, you know, the positional nature of your writing, because you're no longer just kind of a heckler, right? You're talking to people backstage, and that, you know, that changes how you evaluate it. It changes how you watch.
And I think there is a difference between, I think you're right, that people like me who came up in more of a traditional way, I think many of us thought, I want to write, I just want to write.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people who came up in the online and digital area said, either I just want to talk, or I want to write about this. You know, and that subject, you know, subject-driven, I guess, idea is where a lot of that came from, and obviously where your stuff came from. Now, when you started, were you just saying, I love college football and I want to write about it, or is there some particular way of doing it that you had in your head?
I had a couple of people in my head. I always thought what Anna Marie Cox had done with the original Wonkette.com was brilliant. And it occupied this space and this tone that nobody had really taken, right? Because I'd always thought that people who wrote and cared about politics were the stupidest people on the planet. And I still kind of do. I'm like, be real upfront about that. Like, I know people who write at Vox, and they're great, and they're real smart, okay? I know people who write for the New York Times who write about politics, and they're real smart. But generally, there's some people that if you're going to be stupid, you're going to be big stupid if you're writing about politics, right? it's just true. I'm not going to back off that. It's absolutely 100% true. And what I saw in her was somebody who was writing about it real intelligently and really had some remove, and was sort of dispassionate about it, but still obviously cared, right? And that delicate balancing act kept up consistently across, you know, 1, 2, 3 years of what you would consider prime Wonkette. That's incredible. And I thought, you know, yeah, I want to write like that, right? Never too long, never overly serious, and always just sort of hopping to the next thing, but keeping an eye on the larger picture.
Right.
So I tried to do that and failed. And that's really what Every Day Should Be Saturday was and is.
I want to just kind of cleanse the palate just a second and ask you this. What things, if any, do you still unabashedly love about college football?
Oh, plenty of things. I love the players. I think there is an indestructibility, confidence, and yet naivete about people around the age of 18 or 19 sort of figuring out what they can do with their talent, right? And it's very raw. It is very unrefined. It is not necessarily consistent. Technique ain't there. It's not. When somebody says, what's the biggest difference between the NFL and the pros, or the NFL and college? And I go, you know, first of all, the talent level, you're taking 2% off of the top of college, and that's the NFL. They're going to be better at everything. But technique is another thing. You know, it's just not, it's not as polished, and your swings are bigger, and it's pretty much everything that you would get if you make something amateur. I just find that ragged edge to be still the greatest thing about the sport. I don't want it to be too good. I don't want you to get a great producer or fix your bad mic. I like the band the way it sounds, right? The best record the Wu-Tang Clan ever put out was the one that they produced while they were smoking angel dust in a stairwell and recording in like, you know, and recording in like subpar situations. That's what I want. I enjoy the texture and I enjoy the error and I enjoy how, you know, generally unrefined the sport can be. I love the Florida State Band's fourth quarter fanfare. If you've never heard it, you know, it'll put a stake in your heart. It sounds like someone's going to die.
Right.
It sounds like the intro to an Old West showdown. I don't think there is a more fulfilling live sports experience than a really good night game in Baton Rouge for at least, and somebody says, well, what makes it so good? I'm like, I don't have enough time in the day to analyze everything that I think is good about it because I can break it down molecularly to like, okay, it's the following 458 things that make it so good. But if I tell you those, you'll think I'm mentally ill. But I saw them all, right? And can write about it in particulate because I've thought about it way too much. It's an amazing experience. I love, like, more than anything, you know, despite all of its ills, I really do love the surprise that the sport can give you. And this is not a sport of upsets, which makes the moments when there are upsets or unexpected things, you know, or even moments of just sort of like random bravery. It's a contact sport. And contact sports may be dying. They may be evolving as we know it. But there's an element of bravery to being out there that I think I can't really erase. It'd be cool if I could take the machismo out of it, right? Because that can be really toxic and lead to a lot of bad things. But there is an element that I think is common to any sport, but particularly magnified in a contact sport when you have somebody out there who is in a little bit of danger.
When we come back, Spencer Hall talks about paying college football players, why stadiums should shrink, and why Auburn is like a jellyfish. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Looking for some new music for your playlist? WFAE is proud to launch Amplifier, a new music podcast where we explore the sounds of Charlotte music scene. Listen to the trailer right now on WFAE.org/amplifier or on the NPR One app. Amplifier is powered by Ortho Carolina.
Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to spotlight Nancy Miller Campbell, who wrote a lovely email about our episode with Potter Ben Owen III. Here's what Nancy said. As I heard him talk about placing the clay on the wheel and how important the foundation is, all I could think was, that'll preach. Imagine my surprise when you wrapped up the podcast with a reference to picking up another piece of clay and beginning again when the first one has not worked out. You were talking about grace, the ability to be forgiven for our mistakes and begin again. Nancy, that was beautiful. If you enjoy the podcast, we want to hear from you too. You could tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson, email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org, or best yet, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks to everyone for the kind words. Now, back to our conversation with Spencer Hall. I want to ask you, or I guess I just want to tell you a story. So, sure. As you know, I'm a Georgia fan, and you talked about surprise. Mm-hmm. So, I'm watching the Georgia-Alabama game with a group of friends at my house, and I consider myself a reasonable college football fan. One of those people who doesn't go out and, like, blow air horns when my team wins, and I don't, like, sulk in the basement when my team loses. I've never painted my face for a team, right? So, as you know, in the overtime against Alabama, Georgia sacks the Alabama quarterback, And there's 2nd-26 in overtime. Georgia's leading. And probably for the first time in that game, I felt almost 100% sure that Georgia was going to win this game. And obviously, to anybody who's seen the game, the very next play, Alabama throws a touchdown to win the game. I get up. I go to the kitchen. I start washing dishes. From that instant on, I have not seen 1 second of a replay from that game, and I've not read a single word about that game. It's been like 6 months now, 7 months. And I don't know what that says, because I didn't expect I would ever feel that way about a moment like that. And I guess maybe my question is, have you had some moment like that in your watching life?
Couple of them. Yeah, where you think, you know, oh man, I'm not going to get touched, right?
Right.
That's the other, like, you're never out. You're not, right? It's just not, you're never out, so you really shouldn't live under the illusion that you are emotionally. If it might help you to do that, then that's fine. I think everybody goes through long periods of disillusionment with a team. I'm currently in one with Florida.
Right.
Right, where you just go, I wish you would do one thing right. Because when you do, you could be so good. So just do one thing right, right? Show me a sign that you care. That's all I want in this relationship, right? Stop hiring Jim McElwain's, right? Stop making ugly uniforms, right? Stop picking bad fonts. Stop doing little things to show me how much you don't actually care about this team, me, or winning, right? And there are moments like that. 2006 Auburn. I've stayed. I do not leave games early. It's just a thing. I think you should be a completionist, and I think you should stay for the whole thing, even if you're going to sit in 3 hours of traffic, right?
Right.
Instead of 2 hours and 52 minutes of traffic, which is generally what most people save, right? No matter how bad it is, right? I stayed for the entirety of the Will Muschamp era Missouri loss at homecoming, where Missouri did not get 150 yards of offense on the night and still beat us something like, I want to say 34-14, 37-14, right? The worst football game I have ever seen our team play. And I've only left one game early, and that was 2006 Auburn at Auburn, where Auburn really didn't try to do anything. They just watched us stick our face in the tree shredder over and over again, and just like they just wanted to force mistakes, and that's all they did, and they actually didn't try to do anything. And I was just so philosophically appalled by everything happening that at the last turnover that Chris Leak committed with, I think, maybe a minute on the clock or something, I left. And I still feel bad about that, but like I don't like talking about it. I've never rewatched that game. There's no reason to. It's a waste of my life. I'm a little disgusted just talking about it, just in general. Like, why did that ever happen? That's unnecessary. It's the jellyfish of games, right? Why do they exist? Who made them? What a useless
all they do exercise. Is float around and hurt people.
That's all Auburn does. All Auburn does is mess things up. If you're listening to this and you're an Auburn fan, congratulations. Your team has one perfect form and function, and that's to ruin things.
So let's get around. I feel like a lot of stuff that you've written about over the last few years especially, and most of what, I guess, American stories end up with is either money or violence.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about money first. For people who've not paid much attention, haven't given much thought to this over the years, and I think you've given quite a bit of thought to it, why should college football players be paid?
Because they do work. They're labor. We have a long-standing historical issue in this country.
You're laughing like you're saying this is an obvious statement that you should not have to debate, right?
But yeah, you're laughing because otherwise you'd scream. And if you'll notice, the parts of the country that don't really want to pay for this labor, some of them have a historical issue with that, a very nasty historical one with that. Not alone. You know, if you divide college football up, the Big Ten and the SEC are pretty much, you know, 50 to 60% of the net bulk and volume of college football can fit into the shape of the SEC and the Big Ten. Neither of them want to pay their players, and this is something of value. Their labor has value. They do not get compensated adequately for it. Instead, they get paid by a company store. Again, none of this is new. It's slow even, right, to the gig. These are very, very old tricks to cheat people out of money. They should be paid. Now, for anybody who says, well, how could you still watch the sport like that, right? There's a great internet cartoon that says somebody popping up from a well. One person's going, man, you know, like, I think we need, like, you know, healthcare for all people. Or we need, like, a little, we need just, like, this much socialism to get things going the right way. And somebody pops up out of a well, right? And the picture's great. It has, like, the eyes peering over it. And it's like, oh. So you say you're a socialist, but you participate in a capitalist society. I am very intelligent, right? And, well, of course, you're in the midst. You're in the middle of this entire scenario. And if I want to change something, right, I don't do much by withdrawing, right? I might feel a little bit better about myself, but it's still going to happen. I'd much rather advocate. I would much rather consistently say, you know, in general, I support this. And, you know, with money, with time, with energy, right? And then lastly, with emotion, because you can't sell that. The one thing that you can't sell is your work. And I don't see why a linebacker shouldn't be paid to do the brutal hard work that he does for a university instead of pretending to get a criminal justice degree.
I do wonder, by the way, I agree with everything you said there, but I wonder if you've thought about
it. You don't have to.
No, I do. Oh, of course. And there are many, many thousands of people, maybe some listening to this, who don't. But I wonder if you've thought about whether – Let's say that happens, how the game would change, if at all. Do you think, you know, 2 years into this, it would be just like it always was? Or is there something fundamental that paying the players would change about the game?
I think it changes a lot of things, both, you know, things that I know would happen and then things that, you know, everybody would be surprised by, right? I think that you would probably see that the amount of money that it would take would be less than you expect. Say you even called it a part-time gig, right? Say it's, you know, part-time job. That's because, you know, if you can't prove that it's a full-time job, right, in a court of law, then perhaps you can say, okay, well, at least you can agree this is a 20 to 25-hour job. And what should you be compensated for it? Well, probably the following things. I think you get a different relationship in terms of players and coaches. I think that you'd be exercising less power over them. Less soft power, right? Less like fuzzily defined power, like I'll kick you out or I'll ruin your draft prospects. When you have your HR policies are a lot clearer when you're dealing with workers, right?
Sure.
So if there's grievances and if there are complaints and if there are if there are issues, I think you get a much clearer picture. I think players do get more power, and I think they should have more power. But at the same time, they're going to be bound by the same labor laws everyone else is. So I don't think it'll be quite as liberating as players think it will be. It'll just be a new layer of adulthood, right? Like, oh man, I can make my own money. Okay, cool. You're going to have to deal with all of this boring crap now. All of it, right? The tedium of being an employee.
The new scandal will be like if somebody didn't sign their time cards.
There'll be issues over like, okay, how many hours exactly are we working, right? Like that's already an issue because player, you know, when people say, well, how are you going to deal with college football being, you know, regulated? How are you going to deal with government being involved? Okay, what's the arbiter right now? Universities and the NCAA? If you think government regulations don't make much sense and have no basis in reality, let me introduce you to the NCAA's bylaws and then how they're judged and enforced. The government is a relief compared to dealing with the NCAA. I think that if players do get paid, it's bad news for the NCAA, but not the worst because they still get most of their money from basketball until basketball decides to fairly compensate their players. And that's a structure that I don't even want to begin to understand how that would happen because we're only talking about, 130-plus teams in Division I, a.k.a. FBS. Past that in, you know, college, what, you're talking 300 teams?
Oh, more than that, probably, yeah.
More? Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a much more complex problem with less money in the system overall. So that's the one I think, like, okay, you know, football, I can at least see a practicable way of doing this. Basketball, yeah, that's your problem. I'm not even going to, but the math begins to make my head hurt. So I think like the extra sort of prosaic, boring level of adulthood aside, I think the other thing that would happen if you started to pay players is that hopefully we would get something like, I think the sport itself would probably end up downsizing. I don't see certain programs being able to compete at that level. And that to me is natural. I don't think that's, and by natural, I mean we have a system right now in which there are teams that are propped up by membership in a conference. Baylor is only in the Big 12 because of political lobbying at the time of the breakdown of the Big 8 and the Southwest Conference, right? That's how Baylor is in. Ann Richards put her sizable toe on the scale in order to get Baylor in because it's Texas. And if you think politicians are involved in football in the Southeastern Conference, let me introduce you to something called Texas. And I think, too, that you get I think you'd get a smaller FBS or Division I. And then maybe, though, when people say that, I'm like, okay, well, if you really like the way football was in the 1980s and 70s, let me introduce you to what the American Conference will be, right? Because it'll be smaller. I think stadiums are going to downsize anyway because live sports, buying the ticket and showing up doesn't have quite the same pull because you get a good seat at home where I can watch three other games and get a great – most people say, well, why don't they go outside? These kids, you know, only watch TV. Okay, well, if I'm a fan, it's not just that I can watch more games at once without leaving my home. That's nice. Parking my butt on the couch is lovely, right? But – I get a great experience because I can have a camera that's seated right over the center.
Right.
It's that blows my mind. Like, be grateful for that you have a camera which can get you running behind someone as they're going, right? Like on the Sony Michel run, right? On one of his TD runs in the game against Oklahoma in the Rose Bowl, right? Let's get your mind on some happy things here, Tom.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you giving me that.
Yeah, that was a thing of beauty. But you know how you got to see it? You got to see it chasing him like a bird. That's
right.
Science fiction. I can't get that live, right? I'm going to take that. So I think most people like that decline in attendance, I think most of the time they're probably just going to end up raising prices a little bit and downsizing the stadiums. You know, Stanford already did it, right? Not that Stanford's like comparable to anything you'd see in the Big Ten or the SEC, but LSU can't sell out their stadium, and they got like 100,000. And that to me says you should probably bump down to like 70 or 80.
Yeah. The other thing I think about when I think about money in college football is the money paid to coaches in most states, many states. The highest paid state employee is either the football coach of the biggest university or the basketball coach of the biggest university. And that I have this sort of duality about this where I think, for example, obviously Nick Saban seems to be worth even more to Alabama than he's getting paid. But that amount of money and the amount of power there leads to some level of untouchability, I guess. Do you feel like that? There's some, maybe the disparity between the players who don't get anything and the coaches who seem to get everything. Is there some way to shake that out and make it better?
At the moment, no. And I think compensating players inevitably will cut into coaching salaries. It will. That's not sustainable. And again, if somebody says that the coaches are going to have to earn less. Yeah, they probably will. This is again, when I say that the problems in college football should be, this is why I love writing about it, the problems in college football should be instantly recognizable to anyone who lives and works in the United States. They are not unique. They are not original. We don't make this up, right? It's just borrowed as, you know, tactics from other things. And that's probably the case, right? And this is not, the way, there is nothing that says that there is a biblical edict that coaches should make infinitely more money or that they should be continued to be paid at like the $8 million a year level, right? That can fluctuate and has fluctuated. We are not far from Steve Spurrier being the first $1 million coach in college football in 1995, 96, I want to say, somewhere in there. I think it was after the title, so it was 97. He was the first $1 million guy in college football. right?
Now we're closing in on probably $10 million guys, right?
Yeah, there have been years in total compensation where when it was all added up, you know, I think Harbaugh had one year where he was close to 10. Saban, when you factor in everything that Alabama has given him, and this is a story that, you know, I am not a reporter, and I think that's a definite weakness of mine, is that I'm not a reporter. I'm not an investigative journalist. And this is just me openly pleading for somebody to eventually just get the books for Alabama football, because when you add in all of the total compensation just for Nick Saban, that benefits package, it's got to be close to that $10 million range when you factor in everything he gets via connection and or, you know, they paid off his house one year.
Right.
You know, had a $3 million house, and they just, the Alabama boosters, you know, I don't want to say they, Alabama boosters paid that off for him, right? And also, like, in the form of, you know, helping him get set up with what is basically a retirement package, right? You know, that Mercedes-Benz dealership that he has didn't appear out of nowhere, right? That wasn't Nick just writing a check. People help you with that because there are all these unseen benefits for being a coach as well, you know, up to and including, you know, state pensions in some cases.
We talked about money, and I guess that sort of segued, unfortunately, into violence. So you talked a minute ago about how, because of financial issues, if universities pay players, some schools might not play football anymore. And I wonder if you think that's also true as schools start to factor in the physical cost of football to the players, not just the obvious, you know, season-ending ACL tears and that sort of thing, but the things that we're now, you know, learning about, and I think science is fairly conclusive about the effects of concussions that somebody might even play through while they're in a school, but might affect them 10, 20, 30 years down the line. Are some schools going to look at this and say, we can't sponsor this anymore?
Yeah, I think that will happen. Or if they do it, they'll do it at a level where they'll make their own interventions into the game itself and just play it that way. I think actually there is a small and growing core of people in the Ivy League who think that they can have football at a manageable level, played with certain contact rules, and that they, if not leading the way, they'll at least have it their own. They'll have their own thing. And I think that's probably what you'll see, is that you'll see people begin to, at every point when football's evolved, it hasn't necessarily been a uniform thing at all. It's been in fits and starts. It's been playing this way over here and that way over there, and then figuring out a rule to compromise that. It's not written in concrete and never has been. You know, there was a point, at one point in college and football's history, right, which at the point was just college football's history, where kicking at where I think punting somebody through the end zone got you a point or two. So games are essentially just trying to punt through the other team's end zone. Imagine how stultifyingly boring that would have been if football had stayed that way. And I think that's the same for contact and contact rules, right? There are people, and that can go forwards and backwards in terms of innovation. There are still a lot of people who believe that the helmet, if you take off the helmet, and you have people play like rugby players do, head up without any protection on their head, save something to keep their ears from flying off, then you're going to get some more responsible tackling. I think, I'm not definite on this, I'm not one of those people, right? I would like to see the experiments. I would like to see how that might work. But on the whole, we need a game that moves more side to side and has clear contact rules up and down the field, right? And that's to keep – and the greatest, like the most persuasive thing I can say to schools or anyone in power if they were listening was to say, you know, you don't understand. I have to put it in terms you can understand. I can't ask you to be a decent human being because you work for an organization. And organizationally, you're part of that institution. You'll act institutionally. That's your job, right? Liability-wise, it's going to be worth your money in the long run to reduce the amount of force on that field and how it is applied.
I've been trying to sort this out for myself over the last few years as this has become more and more apparent, and I wonder what you've thought about this too. You know, for me, I think one of the things that I love most about football, maybe the thing I love most about the game itself, not the, you know, the stadium or whatever, but the actual game, is those moments when the beauty comes out of the violence. You know, when somebody runs in the middle four times in a row and the fifth time they break through and score. And I just wonder how much of what I've been thinking about, how much of what I love about football and about what people in general love about it is just sort of tied in with the violence of it in a way that is hard to be extracted.
I think when you think of like the plays, I don't think you can ever completely get away from that violence, right? And I don't think you can ever get away from the struggle, because part of what makes football work is either the continual struggle forward or backward, right? With the occasional big break. When people, I don't understand people who cannot watch both soccer and football, because they have the same dynamic. If you translate the score of your average NFL game to soccer goals, it would look a little bit higher than your average EPL game, but not too much, right? Like 4-3, it's 28-21.
Right.
Right? You know, it's 21-14 if you're 3-2. If you start getting into margins and little sort of, and you get field goals, you're not getting a bunch of action that is in some much different from soccer in terms of payoff. I find the most beautiful thing in football, and the thing that will keep you watching, it's like looking at a scene where you see something different every time. And that's if you rewatch it, right? But in a game, you can come back to that same frame and that same set, and I can watch and go, oh man, that left tackle is struggling. Like, watch him. He's fighting as hard as he can, but this dude is just kicking his butt over, just ruining his day, right? I can watch that all day if I figure out what's going on, right? It's also watching somebody in the open field. I think there's the element of the chase and or the contest, right? If it's a ball downfield, watching Randy Moss contest for a ball that could easily be picked was one of the most beautiful things I've seen in sports, because he was going to win every single time the ball was in the air, and he wasn't going to do it with strength alone. He was going to do it with something so dexterous and just quicksilver that you really had to watch the replay, because you're not sure how he brought it down. In the open field, someone in the open field either trying to catch and or evade someone is still my favorite thing in football. It is the reason that I can't take my eyes off Barry Sanders. Like if I'm watching a Barry Sanders highlight tape, if I watched someone like, I'm trying to think of like the best possible comparison, like the current game. If I watch Bryce Love's explosiveness is just, you won't be able to do that your whole life, right? Like you're watching somebody max out the battery. Hopefully he'll have a long NFL career, but you're watching something fleeting, like literally and figuratively, right? It's fleeting because good luck catching up with them. And two, it's seeing somebody who they're not going to be able to do this forever. It's not even like tennis. Like tennis, yeah, you might be able to be good until you're like 30s, but you're going to play your whole life, and you can at least have a passing familiarity. No 60-year-old in their right mind is out there playing football.
Right, right. You wrote something, I think maybe last year, that on November 8th, 2016, which for those of you who don't remember was Election Day, everyone in America realized they're really from the South. Mm-hmm. I think I know what you mean by that. Pretty sure I do. But why don't you explain it?
It was weird. I read Jesmyn Ward did a piece in Time.
In Time, yeah. It's very similar, right?
Very, very similar, right? That she eventually moved back to Mississippi because, in her words, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not getting it totally right, but there was no escape from an infinite room. And everything that is, and this is going back to like a theme that I see in a lot of stuff about the South over and over again. One of the books I read this offseason that really affected me and left me really optimistic, by the way, like a very mature kind of optimistic, hopefully, was Diane McWhirter's Carry Me Home, because Carry Me Home is about Birmingham 63. And the point that she makes was, you know, Birmingham had this spectacular and horrifying series of events that, you know, ended up with the desegregation of schools in Alabama and beyond. And that that's where, you know, like I think every when I say everybody lives in the South, there is no escape from the downsides of the American experiment. There is no relief from it. You can distance yourself from it, but one day it will come to your door, right? Like we just live with the monster 24/7. You've built some distance, some wall. You think that, you know, you'll get the monster light. That's not how it works. You know, it'll be there one day. And I think November 8, 2016, I think for a lot of people, that was the day they heard the knock. Whereas I think people in the South, for better or worse, they're used to having a chair for it on their porch.
Yeah. Nicely said. One last question, and I'll let you go. And maybe not a question, more of a statement or a plea. Please, Spencer, as my friend and as somebody who is knowledgeable about college football, please tell me that Alabama is not going to win the national championship this year.
I can't tell you that.
Damn it.
Yeah, sorry. They're real good. They're real good. Remember, like, again, this is another American thing, right? It's bad right now. Might be bad for a while, but nothing is forever. And the best way to beat Alabama is to both work harder and smarter. And also, if you can have a generational talent who can put up a deep ball against boundary corners in one-on-one coverage and have them come down with it, that helps too. I think you should really get one of those.
I'm trying to write all this down as you say it, and I can't quite keep up. So I'll do my best to get my people on that.
Please do.
On a random fall Saturday, when you can watch live college football from noon until after midnight, it's hard to imagine that the sport would ever shrivel up or even disappear. But 100 years ago, two of the biggest sports in America were boxing and horse racing. Now they're just slivers of what they used to be. The more money that flows into college football while players work for free, and the more those players get injured in ways that could damage their whole lives, the harder it is to justify watching. I love college football more than any other sport, but loving it requires me to sweep a lot of dirt under the rug. The game is so great that it can make me forget every once in a while, but part of me knows the dirt is still there, and I can't just wish it away. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our web manager is Jennifer Lang. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch, and our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, the NPR One app, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has links and show notes about that week's guests. And between episodes, look for the Southbound Radio Hour with a playlist of music based on our most recent guests. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.